Welcome to the She Recovers podcast. I'm Taryn Strong, co-founder with my mother, Dawn Nickel, of She Recovers. She Recovers believes that we are all recovering from something. And here on She Recovers podcast, we examine the healing power of connection and intentional living, as well as what happens in our lives when we put down our past stories and pick up our soul's true purpose. On this episode, myself and Aaron connect with Dina Axe, a She Recovers coach and a self-described believer in love and hope in all circumstances at any cost. In 2015, Dina lost her daughter Morgan to addiction. Morgan was 6 months pregnant at the time, and Dina also lost her grandson, Isaiah. Dina is now dedicated to addiction education and support while fighting for the end of rock-bottom treatment practices and ending the shame and stigma of the disease of addiction. You can learn about Dina and Morgan's story on Dina's Facebook page as well as Instagram page called Addicted to Hope, and you can also find her website at addictedtohope.org. Well, welcome. Thank you so much for taking time for your recovery and for your wellness journey to listen to this episode. This episode, Aaron and I have the pleasure of interviewing Dina Axe. Hi, Dina. Thanks for being here.
Hi, girls. How are you?
Great. Thank you. And those of you tuning in and those of you who have been listening to the podcast so far, you will recognize that this is Aaron and I's first time interviewing one person both at the same time. And the reason for this is I was just sharing with Dina. Dina has touched both Aaron and I in such a powerful way with her story and with the work that she's doing in the world and how she has turned her pain into purpose. And when we were talking about interviewing Dina, we both had this kind of moment where we were like, well, I want to interview her. Well, I want to interview her. And then Aaron suggested that we both interview her. So here we are. And we're both really, really excited to connect.
I'm honored.
And Dina, thanks again for being our guinea pig for this style of interview.
No problem.
So those of you who know you, I mean, Aaron and I aren't the only ones who you have touched profoundly with your story. And I was wondering if you would be comfortable sharing pieces of your story here. So we invited you to talk on one of our panels at our conference in LA in September. And the panel that you were in was We Are All Recovering from Something. And I would love if you would share pieces of what you shared about Morgan in the panel with our podcast listeners.
Okay. Well, my daughter Morgan, my sweet angel, passed away on November 7th, 2015. She was 5.5 months pregnant with my grandson, Isaiah. And she had been clean for, about 8 months, 8.5 months. And she was 5.5 months pregnant. And she relapsed. She had a bad night, and she was looking for Xanax, actually on Facebook. And somebody put her in touch with someone who gave her, or actually talked her into getting heroin. And the heroin ended up being laced with fentanyl. So I found Morgan the following morning, passed away in her room. So it's been quite an agonizing journey, and you know, Morgan's addiction stemmed from her boyfriend committing suicide while he was on the phone with her when she was 17, when she was in high school. And he tragically shot himself while he was on the phone with her, and so she was traumatized, obviously. So that kind of started our descent into this journey of, you know, pain and trauma and addiction, And, you know, Morgan always wanted to help people, and she was always such a kind, fun, loving spirit, and she always wanted to make an impact on people that were hurting. She was always the one that wanted to fix the broken wing. So we had talked about doing speaking together, going out into the community and talking about addiction together. And it just, obviously we didn't get to do it together. I had started Addicted to Hope prior to Morgan's passing to try to eradicate the shame and stigma from addiction and show parents that it's okay to speak out. But it was, again, something that Morgan and I wanted to do together, and we didn't have that opportunity. So I wanted to carry on Morgan's wishes and her legacy. And so Addicted to Hope goes on. So that's kind of where everything started. And unfortunately, 10 months prior to that, I lost my father to a drowning. And, so it's been, you know, it's been a rough couple years, but I've, you know, learned a lot about myself and about grief and addiction and trauma and recovery. So.
Yeah, Dina, this is Erin. I wanted to ask you about the word recovery. As Taryn mentioned, we know we were preparing to talk with you today, and I asked Taryn, well, does Dina think of herself as a woman in recovery? Because I don't know everything about your story. Certainly, I don't know if you had struggled with substance abuse yourself, or if you think of recovery as something that you are in now through this experience with your daughter.
Well, I was not in. I don't consider myself in recovery from substance abuse, but I do consider myself in recovery from the impact of substance abuse. And I, you know, the aftermath, I like to call it, of substance abuse. And my father was an alcoholic. So I'm an adult child of an alcoholic. So I have had ongoing issues with, you know, maybe I would probably say codependency, abandonment type issues from my dad being an alcoholic when I was younger. But the crazy thing is my dad was in recovery for 35 years and relapsed probably about a year before he passed away. And so we kind of got brought back into that world, not only with my dad and then with Morgan. So I consider myself in recovery from many things. Grief, trauma, like I said, the impacts of substance abuse, probably codependency, abandonment.
I think I like how you said that, a recovery from the impact of substance abuse. There was an article out just this week that has found that 1 in 5 Americans are hurt by another person's drinking annually. And yeah, I think that I mean, as you so painfully and intimately know, there's not enough understanding around addiction, let alone what they're calling in this particular study, secondhand addiction. So I'm really grateful for your story today. One of the things that you said when we were in LA, when you were on the panel, is you touched on the idea of what it's like to love someone who is in active addiction. And the words that you said were that you love them all the way through. And I spoke with you afterwards because I just, even just saying those words now, it gives me goosebumps. It's so difficult to stay in and witness a situation that doesn't seem to be getting any better. And I wonder if you can share with us what that was like for you when Morgan was in active addiction, and then even when she was in recovery for those months before, you know, before her passing, did you have a support system? I mean, what people don't necessarily want to stay and watch that. So how did that look for you?
Well, unfortunately, when Morgan started this journey, it would have been about 10 years ago now, not many people were talking about addiction. I think things have improved, you know, drastically as far as people kind of coming out and speaking out about addiction and its impacts. But back then, not many people were speaking about it at all. So it was just something that I was just kind of very adamant about digging my heels into and, you know, saying that, you know, here's this child that was traumatized, you know. And I'm a firm believer in addiction is just any type of addiction, I think, is just a symptom of something deeper. So when people talk to me about how do you love them through it and how do you stay, typically what I say to people is if you peel back the characteristics of addiction and if you peel back the layers of the addiction's mask that it puts on the person that you love, and you look at the pain of where it originated from, and you kind of get right on the floor with that person and look at their pain, you know, you'll see that love is the only way out. And I truly, truly believe that. And it's not until you can look past the actions of the person who is addicted, but looking through, like through their eyes, into their soul, know that they're still in there and love them, that I think you can really start to begin to make peace with where you're at. And I think it makes a big difference. And, you know, unfortunately, back then there was a lot of belief in rock bottom, not knowing, people didn't know a lot about what opiates did to the brain, and the whole opiate epidemic, I think, was just starting to unfold. And so there was a lot of misconceptions about rock bottom. And I had a lot of people that, you know, disagreed with what I was doing. My parents, my family, and it took a lot of, you know, real heart-to-heart talks with my family to get them to understand that, you know, this wasn't, you know, like somebody that, you know, Morgan had a dual diagnosis. She had trauma. She had a lot of other issues. So rock bottom just wasn't an option for me. And so I was willing to lose, let go, let people fall out of my life, you know, and if it didn't really matter to me what people thought. I just did what I knew that I needed to do for my daughter.
Yes. So Dina, you know, it really hits home for me because when I was 16, I was addicted to cocaine and meth and other things, self-harm and disordered eating. And, you know, I had a variety of different things. And it's so similar to how my mother and my parents were dealing with me through this time. They come from a 12-step background, and that was really helpful and wonderful because they had a community of people in recovery to support them as they were navigating this. And what mom says now is that, yes, a lot of the advice that she was given was let her hit rock bottom. She's just going to do what she's going to do. You just have to let her hit that bottom. And my mom did exactly what you did, right? Like, she loved me all the way through, and I knew, like, there was never any shame from my parents. I always knew that I had a safe place to land with them. Mm-hmm. And when I think about, you know, my mom, for example, or when I feel into you speaking, I can't help but know or believe that it must have just been that mother's intuition to love all the way through, because you were getting advice from all the people around you, as my mom was, let the bottom, and you chose love over that. And do you think that was your intuition to guide you in that?
I do. I really do. Because, you know, my father was in Alcoholics Anonymous for, like I said, I think it was 32 years. And my father was very active in the community, in the recovery community. He spoke at a number of different places, we had growing up, we had people living in our basement that my dad was sponsoring. And, so that, you know, he would let them detox for a couple of days and then he'd take them to rehab or, you know, so the 12-step recovery program was always a part of my life. And so, you know, my dad leaned into that hard when it came to his granddaughter. But even my dad, came around to what I was saying after a certain amount of time, knowing that we were dealing with a different demon than alcohol. And I think that when you try to paint such a broad brush, you know, every family is different, every situation is different, every trauma is different, every underlying illness is different. And so to just simply say, let them hit rock bottom, you know, that just doesn't work for me. I believe in raising bottom and I believe in getting to the core of people's issues. And yeah, it was just that thing where everything that people were telling me to do just went against everything that I knew as a mom. And so when it didn't feel right, I knew that it wasn't right. And when, you know, I tell people it's okay to just be a mom. You know, you don't have to be the Nazi all the time. When you're dealing with a child that who has a substance abuse problem, it's okay to just be a mom and love them just like you would love any other child that has an illness. I think people get so caught up in what they think the rules are, that they forget that, you know, we're dealing with somebody that has an illness and we should just do what we would do as a mom regardless. And so that's what I did.
Beautiful. What other advice would you give to moms or parents with kids who are active in their substance use disorders?
The one thing that I found with Morgan is that, and you can probably relate to this, and I'm sure other people that have been through substance abuse can relate to it, is that it wasn't so much about getting high anymore. It was about not getting sick. And I think that when you understand the disease and you understand what the withdrawal is like, and you can, you know, kind of build a bridge to comforting them through that withdrawal process, and it makes it less scary for them, that you start, you know, you can start to build that trust again, and then you can just, you know, help them through that first hurdle. And I think getting them through that first hurdle of that withdrawal process, I think it catapults them into better thinking, clarity, so that they can make better steps moving forward, you know, understanding that, you know, they're not lazy, you know, that they have a brain disease that now has affected their brain and the way that they think and how they can't make good decisions. And, you know, when people tell me, well, I told him he has to make his own arrangements for treatment and stuff like that, you know, I often put the question back to them, you know, have you ever been so overwhelmed with the insurance process that you're ready to, you know, throw your cell phone against the wall? And they say, oh yes, you know, it's horrible. It's so hard to get through. And it's, you know, I don't understand what they're saying. And I say, okay, well, imagine being someone that is going through substance abuse that has, you know, a lack of coping skills, a lack of patience, a mind that's clouded. You know, it's essentially like putting somebody with a mental disability out on the street and asking them to find themselves treatment. It doesn't make sense. It goes against all clear thinking. And I don't know why this is the one disease where we expect people to climb out on their own and do the things that we even have difficulty doing being sober. Right. So to me, it just doesn't make any sense. So that's what I would just say, open your heart to understanding what they're going through And no, it's not about black and white and drawing that line in the sand. It's at the end of the day, do whatever you need to do to save their life.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other changes that you would like to see about how we talk about addiction, or especially pertaining to teenagers or young adults struggling with substance use disorders?
Oh, there's so many. There's mm-hmm. so many. I think the one of the biggest things is the language that we use. It, you know, clean and dirty, and you know, the shame. You know, the shame stories that get put out there that make it almost psychologically impossible for these kids to reach out, because they're told for so long, you know, how awful the people are that are afflicted. And so when they find themselves being the ones that are suffering, they feel as though they can't reach out, because now they've become what their parents have told them never to become. And so when we don't talk about mental health and we don't talk about substance abuse in the vein of it being a disease, it casts shame upon these kids. And then we end up losing these kids, not because of the addiction itself, but the shame that goes with it. And I say that from personal experience, because Morgan was on Vivitrol and it was great for her. And she, you know, she was like a new person. And having that medical and, you know, the medical and the, what's the word? The medication assisted treatment side of it, you know, gets such a bad rap. But for her to have that, it was like she was a new person. But when she found out she was pregnant, she couldn't continue the Vivitrol. So when we had to stop the Vivitrol, I said, Morgan, what about Subutex, or what about some other type of medication assisted treatment? And the first thing out of that child's mouth was, no, Mom, I am not going to be one of those girls up at the hospital with their child withdrawing and feeling the shame and the way that people are going to treat me because my baby is going through withdrawal because I was an addict. And so, you know, that just gave me the chills, because I feel like had things been almost as if they are now, I think we're getting a little bit better, but we have a long way to go. But I feel like if that shame didn't exist, even in the medical community, that maybe Morgan would have gone on another type of medication assisted treatment. And maybe, just maybe, she would still be here. I don't know. But so I speak that with personal experience. What we say and how we say it makes such an impact. You know, even though she knew that she was loved by me and her family, and everybody had come to love her and try to lift her up, that shame that still existed still prevented her from going all the way with maybe what she knew she really needed to do.
When we were discussing the parts of your story that we knew and what we wanted to ask you, Taryn was, you know, her questions were often more focused on, you know, as it does, your own experience. So she was coming at it, as she mentioned, from somebody who had sort of been in the position of your daughter. And as I listen to you, I am in the position of the mother. And this idea that even how we're talking about addiction to our children at such young ages, when nobody, you know, when there's not an active threat of them being exposed to drugs, or, you know, thinking that that might be something they want to try, is really powerful. This idea of the language we're using to just describe it, let alone once it's happening in your home, the language you use to describe it.
Right. You know, I hear people say, well, you don't want to be one of those bad kids. You know, you don't want to be in the wrong crowd, or in the, you know, the way that people just put it out to these kids, that so if they do begin to struggle how are they going to find the means and the courage to be, you know, to ask for help when they're going to feel as though that they have become everything that their parents didn't want them to become, you know, that sense of shame will always override the love that they think that their family has for them. I feel like shame is such a barrier to a lot of people moving forward and a lot of people reaching out for help.
So how have you passed into this stage with her gone and with your own work now that you describe as yourself being in recovery from, you know, from her dying? How have you moved into that? And how have you experienced other people either supporting you or pulling away from you?
Well, it's, you know, it's been that part of it. It's, you know, one of the ancillary losses, I like to call it, that comes from losing a child to overdose, that there's still that sense of, well, you should have saw that coming type of attitude, I think, that people have. And so, you know, I was very lucky that I was very supported in the beginning, and a lot of people were around. But, you know, after a certain amount of time, I think people just don't know what to say, so they don't say anything at all. And so people just, you know, the world keeps spinning, and so people just jump back on and don't know how to pull back and hold space for people in pain. And I think especially when it has to do with a death that is, you know, a suicide or an overdose or some other death related to something to do with mental health, I think that people are just afraid, and they, you know, I feel like people think that, I don't know, sometimes I feel like I was like everybody's worst nightmare coming true. So they didn't, you know, they couldn't look me in the face, because whether they wanted to admit it or not, you know, someday this could have been them. But you lose a lot of friends, and you lose a lot of relationships. And for a long time, you know, I'll admit I was angry. You know, I was very angry. But the more that I've learned and studied about grief, and the more that I've come to learn about compassion and forgiveness, the more I just understand that people just didn't know what to do. And it's, you know, it's an area that needs much more discussion and openness and education. You know, people just don't deal well with death, and they don't deal well with pain. And people, if they can't fix it, then they just would rather avoid it. And, you know, it's a prickly thing. And people can't just kind of sit within the mess. You know, they have to avoid it or fix it. And so it's one of the things that I'm very passionate about now is giving parents that have lost children to overdose a safe place to land, and knowing that they're not alone, and in understanding that they just need to be held. They just need to be held. We just need to hold these people up with love. And many of these people hadn't discussed the addiction. And that was so that there's so many other elements that come with an overdose death, that there's so much compounded grief and complicated grief that goes along with it. You know, that's a whole nother podcast, girls. That's a whole nother thing. It's just, yeah, it's a whole nother animal. It really is.
Well, I know that one of the things I think that you have use to help you heal is creativity. And you have a beautiful Etsy page with your art. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So Morgan was a great artist, and Morgan always expressed herself through doodling and journaling and writing. And one of the probably greatest forms of expression that Morgan and I had with each other was always leaving each other notes. And I still have one on my refrigerator that she wrote me, you know, love you, mommy, have a great day, with this big, huge heart. And everything that Morgan wrote on or wrote you had this big heart around it. So when you see my hope notes, the hearts that surround all my hope notes are inspired by Morgan. And, you know, as I kind of needed an outlet for, you know, my pain, I just started to doodle, and I would just start to, I thought, well, she expressed so much pain. You know, I would go back through and read her journals and look at her pictures and her drawings. And I saw them from a whole different light. And I thought, wow, she was really just expressing her heart and her pain and her love and her faith and, you know, all the good things too. So I said, maybe that would work for me. And so I just started drawing and doodling, and then I just thought of, wow, you know, maybe these could be used for just opening hearts and opening lines of communication with people. If, you know, if somebody's suffering, could buy the hope note that says, love me till I'm me again, and send it to their dad and say, you know, daddy, I'm still me, you know, whatever they needed to say, maybe that would open up a line of communication and build a bridge to peace for a family somewhere. So that was kind of the inspiration behind Hope Notes. And so it's been a really healing thing for me, and I hope that it's giving other people healing in the process. And so all the Hope Notes have to do with mental health and hope and faith and pain and grief and, you know, the sticky stuff that people don't like to talk about. I find it's easier if you write somebody a note and you kind of just start the conversation that way. So that's where that came from.
That's beautiful. I love that. I didn't realize that that was the inspiration behind them. Mm-hmm. And we will add a link to them in the show notes so everybody can check them out. And other than creativity, what else does your patchwork of recovery look like? What are your tools? What are your non-negotiables?
Silence is one of my big ones. Because of my trauma from finding Morgan, I have to set aside time even throughout my workday where I just have to find silence. And just let my brain rest and not have stimuli or, you know, I've become very sensory, what's the word I'm looking for? See, trauma brain's kicking in here. I have a lot of issues with loud noises, and stuff like that. Chaos gets me. So, I have to really ground myself many times throughout the day. I also have to be very deliberate about things. I have to pull myself back in a lot of times and just be very deliberate, but then also know that I have to give myself permission to have limited expectations of myself sometimes. You know that, okay, you've hit the wall, your trauma brain's kicking in, give yourself a break, get up, walk around. You know, I used to feel so bad about myself that I wasn't the person that I used to be cognitively. My personality wasn't the same. You know, I've changed. And so that bothered me for a long time, but I've just come to accept that, you know, I'm not that person anymore, and that's okay. and I'm building a new person with all the new tools that I've learned, and you know, that's why I'm so grateful to She Recovers. And you know, the first time that I talked to your mom, I felt like I was home. You know, your mom just really opened my heart like I can't explain. And I really believe it saved my life. You know, I was in a really bad place then. And so going out to LA and seeing everybody and the connection, and I learned a lot from that experience about connection and about not isolating. And, you know, and I've also learned that, you know, to balance that, you know, you can walk through life with grief in one hand and joy in the other, and to not beat myself up for smiling or experiencing something good. You know, I try to really make my peripheral pretty small, stay in today and know that I have everything that I need for today, and just kind of be grateful for the things that I have in front of me. And, you know, having a gratitude practice, as kooky as it used to sound to me, you know, really, really does make a difference. You know, like when I first went out to She Recovers, I was talking about yoga and journaling and gratitude and all these things. I was like, oh my God, take your journal and stick it. You know, like, are you journaling? No, my daughter's dead. I'm not journaling. You know, it's like, I was like, oh God, I'm not in the right place. But, you know, come to find out, all these things really work. You know, I mean, and that's just me. I'm just, you know, I just put it out there. And, but things, you know, they do work. And when I talk to people that I'm coaching, or, you know, I talk to people that are trying to find new ways of coping, I say, you know, this is going to sound kooky to you, or it's going to sound canned, or it's going to sound, you know, crazy, but these things really work. The gratitude, the journaling, the drawing, the, you know, the walking, the breathing, the silence. I think people take silence for granted. I think we're so stimulated all the time that we forget to just sit in silence. You know, people, you know, will say, I'm meditating, and then they put on a guided meditation, and then something's in your ears. You know, I just feel like I can't even do that. Like, I have to have complete silence and just sit and breathe.
Yeah, I love that. That's the advice that I always give to folks who reach out as well, is just stay open and try everything, right? Don't until you try it. Try all of the things, try them a few times, and then if that thing doesn't work, move on to the next thing, and to make sure that you do have this patchwork of all different types of tools. So thank you for sharing that.
Absolutely.
Now, we are so honored and so lucky, so damn lucky. Like, I'm pinching myself right now thinking about it, because you are one of our She Recovers coaches.
I am.
And you are helping us spread the She Recovers love in New York City. And I know that you had a sharing circle this past Sunday. We're recording this at the end of June. And I want to know two things. I want to know how that sharing circle was. And I also would love to know, how important is community? You've touched on it a little bit. How much is community and connection to other women to you? And how has it been in this journey of healing grief?
I mean, the grief piece of it, I can't stress enough how much that connection with other moms who have lost kids has been. You know, I have made some incredible friendships, and that have brought light into such darkness, you know. And they say that the platitude, you know, something, you know, good will come out of this. And I believe that is true, because I've made just some amazing friends that have gotten me off the floor more times than I can count. And I've done the same for them. And, you know, I went to so many psychiatrists and different people to try to talk about my grief, but unless that is, I think it's the one thing that if you haven't lived it, you really truly can't understand it. And so I hope to be that person for people. And you know, when you walk the journey of grief, it's like you know, you always want to have one hand behind you, kind of pulling the people behind you because you're, you know, a little bit further ahead of them. And then you want to keep one hand grabbing for the people ahead of you in the journey so that you can see the hope that's down the road. And so that connection within that grief community is so important. And, you know, the She Recovers Sharing Circle for upstate New York has just been, the first meeting was Sunday and it was such a gift. I mean, we had young women and we had older women and we had just everybody was recovering from different things, but we just all came together and we connected and it was really beautiful. And it was really an honor for me to facilitate it and to share the principles of She Recovers with people and to see their eyes light up. Like, I found a home, you know, for whatever it is that I'm recovering from, I found a home in this place, in this sacred place. It's really powerful. And I'm really excited to bring it, you know, to other areas of upstate New York. We started in Syracuse and I hope to, you know, go east towards Albany and west towards Buffalo and Rochester because upstate New York is huge. So we have to kind of spread it along the cities. And I can't wait to go to New York City in October when She Recovers, and a lot of good stuff coming up. So I'm so grateful to be a part of this community. And it truly did save my life.
I just wanted to circle back real quick to something that you said about all the different tools, the journaling, the meditating, and how you thought they were kooky. And it just seems to me like that has a bit of the same messaging as when you were loving Morgan all the way through and you were using alternative tools to do that. And I just think when you what I love about She Recovers and what I love about the work all three of us are doing in our own ways is not only are we changing the language around recovery, but changing the tools that we've brought to these situations. And honestly, what I think we're doing is infusing them with the feminine and bringing back love and softness into these very painful situations that really can only be met adequately with love and softness. So if it's kooky, I hope you try it.
Yes, that's so true, Erin. Yeah. That is so true, Erin. I never really thought about it that way, but that's very impactful. Yes. And it's so true. And going against the norm and going against the things that we had always believed about recovery will save lives. And I'm sure of it. And I have heard from many people that said, "You gave me permission to love my child when everybody told me that it was wrong." And what I always tell people is you don't need anybody's permission to love your child through their substance abuse. You don't need anybody's permission. You don't need anybody's approval. At the end of the day, all that matters is that your child is alive, and that's it. That's all that matters.
I'm so grateful for your story and your bravery, and I was blown away when you spoke in LA, and I have carried your words with me, and I'm just grateful to have you in my life.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. You know, helping people is the best way to heal. I think, you know, it's the only thing that helps me at this point. I don't want to say the only thing that helps me, but it sustains me knowing that I'm doing what she wanted and what she had always hoped for. And that every time I, you know, talk at a school or I speak somewhere And the kids come up and talk to me, and I know that they feel as though they can reach out and get help, then I know that she's still alive, you know, that she's still here and that her force is strong. So thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Dina. That's so beautiful. And I would like to know if there is anything else that you would like to add or say, or any last pieces of advice for moms grieving the loss of a child. Anything you want to share?
I for anyone grieving the loss of a child, I would just say that know that you're not alone, and try to reframe the way that you think about the loss, knowing that grief truly is love and that love never ever dies. And you know, I always say, instead, when I speak to Morgan, I would always say, "I miss you, I miss you," and I would cry and I would cry. And now I say, "I'm loving you. I'm so loving you. You know, I'm just loving you, Morg." And you know, extending out to her in that way and just reframing that one little thing has helped me a lot. And so how we tell this grief story to ourselves really makes a big difference. So I think talking about it and finding people that have gone through the same thing can really bring new life into you, and to not isolate, because I know for me, for a long time, that's what I did. And then when I finally came out for some air and some light, I could breathe again. So.
Well, thank you so much for sharing a piece of yourself and your heart and your story. And I hope you know that you are changing lives every single day. You are changing lives and you are saving lives. And I just want to thank you for having these hard conversations and talking about the things that people would rather avoid and not talk about. I can only imagine that that isn't easy for you to do. So thank you for being so brave and so open to do this work.
Oh, you're welcome. It's my pleasure, and I'm honored to be here and talk to you both. And I love you both.
We love you so much.